Good evening. We begin tonight keeping him honest with the person who's hard to keep honest, Congressman George Santos, who said today he's stepping away from his committee assignments, and the House Republican leadership seem inclined right now, at least, to just leave it at that. Quoting from the congressman's statement, with the ongoing attention surrounding both my personal and campaign financial investigations, I have submitted a request to Speaker McCarthy that I be temporarily recused from my committee assignments until I'm cleared. The New York Republican, who's been disowned by his own local Republican leadership for lying to them and who's facing calls to resign from other members of his New York Republican House delegation, says he expects to be fully cleared. Why, you might ask, does he think that? Because, and these are his own words today, quote, I have nothing to hide. Which wasn't even true when he said it, because when asked which network he'd just done an interview with, he refused to say. It was OAN. So, yeah, he did have at least one thing to hide today. He also promised the interview would be, quote, fun and, quote, comprehensive. Fun, we'll leave that up to you. But you can certainly say that in the 12-minute clip the network posted late today, the congressman who's lied about his religion, his education, his ancestors, and his career, criminal charges, his athletic accomplishments, and more, was far from comprehensive. In those 12 minutes that were released, he wasn't asked about specific lies and mentioned nearly none of that admittedly non-comprehensive list of things he's lied about. Maybe there is more that hasn't been released. We'll see. In what was released, Santos seemed to suggest he'd already said enough.
I've made my sincere apology multiple times. I earlier said it, that I thoroughly apologize for lying about my education and embellishing the resume. I've made that very, very clear. I don't know what more can be said other than admitting. Is there anything more humbling and humiliating than admitting that on national television, Caitlin?
Actually, yes, Congressman, there is, since you asked. There is something more humiliating than admitting you lied about your education and embellishing your resume, and that would be admitting you lied both publicly and privately and personally, it seems, in your life to nearly everyone, it seems, for a very long time. That would probably be more humbling and humiliating if you did it, which you haven't, and if you actually were capable of being humiliated, which seems unlikely since you appear to be utterly incapable of feeling shame. When asked what he might have done differently, he merely said he wouldn't have lied about his education. Quote, I would have just fought like hell, he said, to get the nomination. And then at the end, he said this.
And I've learned my lesson, and you can guarantee, I can guarantee you that from now on, anything and everything is always going to be above board. It's largely always been above board. I'm just going to go the extra step now to double check, cross-reference everything.
So he just said everything from now on is going to be above board and double checked. And then in the very next sentence, he lied and said it's largely always been above board, as in his past statements and actions have been largely above board, honest. Statements like these.
Good morning. Shabbat shalom to everybody.
I've seen how socialism destroys people's lives because my grandparents survived the Holocaust.
I'm a Latino Jew.
My mom was a 9/11 survivor.
They sent me to a good prep school, so, and which was Harrisman Prep in the Bronx.
I actually went to school on a volleyball scholarship.
But I put myself through college and got an MBA from NYU.
When I was in Baruch, we were the number one volleyball
team. Did you graduate?
But I also founded my own nonprofit organization.
I sacrificed both my knees and got very nice knee replacements from HSS playing volleyball.
It was in summer of 2021 on Fifth Avenue and 55th. I was robbed by two men.
I've lived an honest life. I've never been accused, sued of any bad doing.
Good morning. Shabbat shalom to everybody.
Just for the record, none of that is true, except that it's a Shonda. The congressman is also facing a federal investigation into his finances, a local investigation in New York. His latest campaign finance disclosure forms have raised questions, and yet the Republican House leadership still says it's not for them to tell him to resign.
I've already commented on this numerous times, and again, it's going to play itself out. But ultimately, voters are going to make that decision, whether it's in the primary election or in the general election.
Well, that would be 2 years from now. That's New York Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, the fourth ranking Republican in the House, who's come under fire for vouching for Santos during the campaign and working hard to help him win. As for House Speaker McCarthy, he didn't weigh in today, but made it clear a week ago it's not his job either to show Santos the door.
You know why I'm standing by him?
because his constituents voted for him. If for some way, when we go through ethics, that he has broken the law, or you know, then we will remove him. But it's not my role.
Well, that's the new standard. As long as you're not a criminal, you're good. The congressman's constituents apparently disagree. New polling in his district shows voters there by a 78-13% margin say he should resign, including 71% of Republicans. More now from CNN's Melanie Zanona at the Capitol. So what more are you learning about Congressman Santos stepping down from his committees?
Well, George Santos has really been defiant up until this point. But, Anderson, the pressure has been growing on him to resign. He is facing multiple investigations, including into his finances. And so I suspect that this move to temporarily remove himself from committee assignments is a way to try to take some of the heat off of him and his party. And Santos said earlier today that it was his decision to step aside. Take a listen.
Did McCarthy tell you to step away from the committees?
Nobody tells me to do anything. I made a decision on my own that I thought best represented the interests of the party.
Now, the issue did come up in a meeting between Santos and Kevin McCarthy last night. And Kevin McCarthy told us earlier today that he thinks it is an appropriate move by George Santos to give up his committee assignments. And that's because this has become a huge distraction for House Republicans and a huge political liability, especially as they try to remove a Democratic Congresswoman, Ilhan Omar, from one of her committee assignments. So it was becoming an increasingly difficult position to Republicans to take here. And there definitely was a sigh of relief inside the House GOP today. But not every Republican is satisfied. In fact, two New York House Republicans put out a statement saying this is like someone quitting right before they're about to be fired. And they said that Santos still needs to do the right thing, and that is to resign. Anderson.
Melanie Zanona, appreciate it. Thanks. With us now, former Illinois Republican Congressman Joe Walsh, host of the White Flag podcast, and also CNN Inside Politics Sunday anchor Abby Phillip. Abby, so Santos is saying he wants to properly clear his name before returning to his committees. As we see on a daily basis, including this last sort of interview, he's not forthcoming with regards to the vast majority of his lies. I mean, does this just kind of slug along and careen along like this?
I think it's going to, Anderson. I mean, look, this latest move really just shows that Republican leadership is not willing to put public pressure on George Santos to step aside or really to do anything. They allowed this move of him recusing himself from the committee to be his, to be framed at least publicly as his decision, even though it's clear here that it's something that actually benefits Kevin McCarthy as he's trying to go about the rest of the agenda that he's laid out for his party. This is not someone in George Santos who has a lot of remorse or even a lot of shame for some of the lies that he's told. You played so many of them today, but you know he hasn't even explained. Reporters were asking him questions about why he claimed his mother died on 9/11 when she wasn't even in the country. I mean, some of these lies are really reprehensible, and this is not someone who seems to be having any sort of real remorse over his willingness to lie to his constituents and the country in this way.
Yeah, I mean, Congressman Walsh, do you actually believe this is Santos voluntarily stepping down from his committees? I mean, a guy who seems so shameless. He just met recently privately with Kevin McCarthy. Do you think it's very possible that McCarthy, you know, suggested or told him, look, take attention away from us and away from yourself, step down from these committees and let this thing work out?
Oh, absolutely, Anderson. I think it's probable that McCarthy told them, hey, look, buddy, help me out here, right? Here's the deal. Kevin McCarthy needs to be speaker. He needs to stay speaker. He needs this Santos stuff to kind of try to go quiet. And the other thing, Anderson, is Kevin McCarthy, because his caucus is demanding it, is hell-bent on removing Ilhan Omar from her committee, which is a despicable thing to do, but this puts McCarthy in a real tough spot if he's still got George Santos on all these committees. Anderson, I got to say this, Santos is a huge distraction to Republicans. But man, Republicans created this distraction because from the moment this news broke, as you demonstrated, they've never held him accountable. And here's the damnedest thing, Anderson, it's only going to get worse. We're talking about his lies now. We're going to be talking about federal crimes and federal finance campaign finance violations pretty soon.
Abby, you heard Congressman Santos in that softball interview say that he's learned his lesson and from now on everything's going to be above board. Is there a possible move that voters in his district would try to recall him? Is there anything, a chance of that?
Well, I think that from everything that we've seen, a lot of voters in his district are trying to put as much pressure as they can to force him into a resignation. I just don't think that there's much from the mechanics of how these elections work for them to do that. There's no sort of, recall procedure like there is in some other states. So they're really in a bind here, and they're relying on just using their voices and the bully pulpit that they have as voters. I think a lot of his voters right now feel pretty powerless in this situation. And so do his colleagues in New York. Other Republicans in that state are trying to get this guy out as quickly as possible because they believe that it reflects negatively on them. These are Republicans, many of them in purple states that Biden won. They believe they're the tip of the spear when it comes to a Republican majority. And they're worried about what this could all mean for them in 2 years. When they are up for re-election once again, and they have to answer for why George Santos's lies wasn't enough for him to be really pushed to the corners of the party or pushed out of the party in this Congress.
Congressman Walsh, does this hurt the people in his district? I mean, if he's completely just, you know, constantly scuttling about, you know, trying to avoid things and not on any committees. And does he actually do anything? Does he actually serve his constituents?
No, Anderson. And that's such a great point. That's the pathetic deal here, is that district for 2 years will, in essence, go without a representative. And shame on George Santos for that. But really, Anderson, shame on the entire Republican conference. Abby's right that members of the New York delegation have spoken out against him, but doggone it, he's lied about everything. The entire conference should call him out. McCarthy should call him out, but they won't. I don't think he's running again, Anderson. I think they've probably already cut that deal, and he'll just try his best to be quiet for 2 years.
Joe Walsh, Abby Phillip, thanks. I appreciate it. Coming up next, breaking news in the police killing of Tyre Nichols, the existence of more videos of it, and when authorities say they will release them, and later how and why the new House Ethics Committee will include another election denier who voted against certifying 2020 presidential election results in the hours directly after the January 6th attack. There's breaking news tonight in the police killing of Tyre Nichols, whose funeral is tomorrow in Memphis. New reporting from CNN's Shimon Prokipes. City authorities say that there will be more videos released when the administrative investigation is complete, adding that this will be footage the, quote, family/lawyer has viewed. This comes as new reporting by the New York Times and CNN raises questions about why the initial police report of Mr. Nichols' fatal January 7th encounter with police did not reflect what video of his beating and subsequent medical neglect clearly show. As Shimon Prokipes reports for us, that divergence between what actually happened and the officer's account of it may have begun at the scene of what is now an alleged murder.
Memphis police officers in the moments after the beating of Tyre Nichols attempting to justify what happened.
I see him. Man. You turn around.
This is the earliest look at how the officers tried to control the narrative after some delivered brutal punches and kicks, even while Nichols was restrained.
We got him out of the car. We was like, hey, bro, you good? Motherfucker swung, bow, almost hit me.
You reached for Martin's gun, yeah, when slammed to the car, you were on enough.
In a CNN analysis of body camera videos released by police, we have been unable to see Nichols reaching for any of the officers' guns or swinging at any officers, as they claim.
He literally had his hand on my gun, like, that motherfucker was on there.
Fuck me, man.
I don't know what that man. And he's strong.
In fact, what can be seen is officers holding his hands before he eventually frees himself and runs away.
That motherfucker
high.
After the beating, the officers repeatedly remarking how strong Tyre Nichols was, claiming he must have been on drugs. According to his family, Tyre Nichols was 6'3" and weighed just 150 pounds. The toxicology reports are still pending. As someone who appears to be a supervisor arrives on scene, one officer describes the initial stop.
So
So we tried to get him stopped. He didn't stop. We still trying to get him stopped. Hit the siren. Stop. That man drove around, swerved like he's gonna hit my car. So then I'm like, God damn, man, what are we doing? He pull up to the red light, stop at the red light, put his turn signal on. So we jump out the car. Shit went from there.
Memphis Police Chief C.J. Davis has since told CNN that so far they have found no evidence Tyree Nichols was driving recklessly.
We've looked at cameras, we've looked at body-worn cameras, and even if something occurred prior to this stop, we've been unable to substantiate that.
As Tyree Nichols' limp body lies against a squad car, they again claim he must be high and instruct him to sit up.
Hey, sit up, bro.
And new information tonight, in a photo of an initial police report, the contents of which have been confirmed by the Shelby County District Attorney, we see how an officer, we still don't know who, described what happened. It makes no mention of officers punching and kicking Nichols, and instead accuses Nichols of actions to provoke the officers. A CNN analysis of the released body and poll camera don't corroborate. It says that, quote, Nichols grabbed for a detective's gun, and that he was, quote, actively resisting by pulling duty belts and grabbing an officer's vest. An officer at the scene, one of the five now charged with second-degree murder, Emmett Martin, is even listed as a victim on the report. In Memphis, as preparations are underway for a funeral Wednesday, family lawyers say they believe there was an attempt to cover up the circumstances of Tyree Nichols' death.
It is consistent with Ms. Rovine, Tyree's mother, said from the beginning when they told them that they could not go to the hospital because Tyree had been pepper sprayed and tased and that he was arrested. She said she believed that she thought it was a conspiracy to cover it up from the beginning.
Simone Procopez, CNN, New York.
So with that as a backdrop, we're joined by CNN political commentator and former Obama senior advisor Van Jones, also CNN law enforcement and intelligence analyst John Miller, former New York Police Department Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism. So, John, in a case like this where the initial police report certainly appears to be contradicted by all the body camera video of the arrests, is that a sign that the Memphis police were attempting to cover up or downplay exactly what happened that night? I mean, the video, it seems like they're trying to write the narrative from the moments while he's still there.
Well, that's exactly how you could interpret it. In fact, you see it in three parts, right? I mean, first, there is the conversation, which is they are creating the story, which is he tried to grab my gun, he did this, he did that. They know there's body camera, but they also know that camera blinks, especially in a confusing situation. Often the view is blocked. Some of those things, you know, they think they can get away with saying. The second part is validating that story, which is writing it into an official report, which is later done at headquarters, and that's filed at 4:40 in the morning. But the third piece is, you know, the one camera that doesn't blink here is the one on the pole, and that's the one that sees a lot of the things that they leave out of their report and doesn't see a lot of the things that they wrote into it. So I think you're looking at, you know, certainly administrative charges for officers who helped concoct that story beyond the assault charges, and maybe for the officer who wrote it.
Vin, the police initially said that George Floyd died of a medical incident. It was, this, of course, the cell phone video from a bystander that later informed the world of what had actually happened. In the Nichols case, it was the city of Memphis itself that actually released the body camera video that seems to undermine the initial report. What is that? Does that speak to you of anything?
Listen, I hope that people start to wake up. There's a myth that we have in American society that a police report is written by Moses or Jesus or Buddha. It is a complete, accurate, perfect description of what happened. It's not. It is a city employee who's writing down stuff that's going to make sure that he doesn't get in trouble and the person who's arrested does get in trouble. That nobody's ever going to write a police report and says, you know what, I lost it today, I kicked the guy in the face, probably should have done it, that's my police report. Every police report reads the same because they are coached legally what they need to assert to justify what they did. So juries need to stop believing that police reports are these completely, you know, perfect descriptions of what's going on. They are always written from a police officer's point of view to protect themselves. And now you're beginning to see they don't match the video time and time again. That's not new. That's not just about Tyree. That is standard behavior across the country with law enforcement.
John, this new video that authorities say they'll release soon, why would that not have already been released? I mean, if they've released this other videos.
Well, I think what they did is the district attorney and the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation said, we are finished with our criminal probe to the point that we're prepared to bring charges. And now you can release the video from the criminal probe. I think a lot of the administrative probe, and this is triage, the most serious people were dealt with first. Now they're getting out to people that may not be criminally charged, but may end up getting charged administratively or fired from the department. And when they are done with that, which they say will take a couple of weeks, they said possibly several weeks, they say they'll release those too. There is an obligation to transparency, but not transparency in real time. We understand they're being more transparent than many other agencies we've seen in the same position, but it's going to go in stages.
Van, as you know, obviously the five officers who've been charged so far are black. We learned yesterday two additional officers have also been relieved of duty in the aftermath of the arrest. At least one of them is white. Why do you think we only found out about those additional officers now? Do you think that was developing, or do you think it was already they already knew that they were going to be charged?
Yeah, it's really hard to know, and it does seem like that there's something that's happening that there are people, including the sheriff's department, that didn't know that they had sheriff deputies there until after it was shown on television. So on the one hand, I agree. The Memphis City leadership has done a better job than usual. They were fired quickly. They were charged quickly. But you can still see it's, there's a little bit of Keystone Cops here where you would think that with this much video evidence, you would have gotten everybody charged right away and that we'd be in a better place. Who knows what else is going to come forward?
All right, Van Jones, John Miller, appreciate it. Coming up, what happens when there are ethical questions about some of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's new picks for the House Ethics Committee? We're about to find out. While Congressman Santos recuses himself from committee assignments, other Republicans tonight are getting placed on House committees, most notably the Ethics Committee. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy named them today, and of the five GOP members, some are veterans of the last committee, but three are election deniers. They include the new chairman, Congressman Michael Guest, Congressman John Rutherford, and Congresswoman Michelle Fischbach, who joins the panel. Each of them voted against certifying the presidential election results in the hours after the January 6th insurrection. Chairman Guest, the leader of the Ethics Committee now, also signed on to the amicus brief supporting the Texas lawsuit that tried to block millions of voters' ballots in the battleground states. The brief was riddled with conspiracy theories about widespread voter fraud that simply did not exist. Supreme Court threw out the case, and he co-sponsored a bill for what he called potential pitfalls with mail-in voting, though there have never been any widespread issues. While you soak that in, here's what Speaker McCarthy said last week after throwing two Democrats off a different committee.
This is not anything political. This is not similar to what the Democrats did, but integrity matters.
Integrity matters. We notice on the Ethics Committee website this reminder for Congress. When in doubt, please call the committee. Following guidance provided by the committee can protect you from future investigations, which raises a question of who you're supposed to call about someone trying to say, let's overturn an election when the person who's chairing it tried to do exactly that. With us now, CNN political commentator Alyssa Farah Griffin. She served as the White House communications director under the last president. Also CNN senior political commentator David Axelrod, who advised then-President Obama. David, what does integrity matter here in this Congress?
The early signs are not good, Anderson. I mean, look, if you are willing to subvert the Constitution and vote to overturn election results based on lies, based on evidence that is fraudulent, are you really going to sit in judgment of other members of Congress? It's a joke. And the new chair of the committee is the worst of the three because he introduced a bill right after the election suggesting that mail-in voting was somehow fraudulent. He joined the Texas lawsuit that was so frivolous and so dangerous to try and overturn the election. And now he's chairman of the Ethics Committee. It's very disturbing. And it comes on top of the fact that as part of the deal making around McCarthy getting chosen as speaker, some measures were taken in the rules that basically gutted the Office of Congressional Ethics, which was an investigating arm of the Congress. It basically paralyzed it. And so, you know, the idea that ethics is going to have a say in this next Congress seems very, very remote.
Alyssa, I mean, is this all part of the deal making that was done behind closed doors with McCarthy to get him to be Speaker?
It's possible. The House Ethics Committee is technically a B committee. It's not one of the A committees people are desiring to be on, but it does stand out that election deniers were appointed to it. Keep in mind, the former Congress made referrals to the Ethics Committee for four sitting House members to be investigated for their roles in January 6th. Jim Jordan, Andy Biggs, Kevin McCarthy, and Scott Perry. This basically assures that those will never go anywhere and they will not be investigated, having a fellow election denier as the chair. I also think it has implications for George Santos, who is under investigation or investigation.
Right. They'll be looking at Santos.
They'll be the ones telling us if he's unethical, if he's dishonest. So I think a committee that's one of the few in Congress that for decades has been fairly bipartisan is probably going a very different direction.
David, so far the priorities of the McCarthy-led majority seem to be kick the certain Democrats off certain committees, investigate President Biden, engage in brinkmanship over the debt ceiling, which is certainly their prerogative. They won the House. How does that agenda track with the priorities, you think, of the general public?
Well, they don't. And, you know, I think some of this was very predictable when we sat together watching those 15 rounds of voting for Speaker, because with each round, McCarthy and his agents were making deals with the rebellious House Freedom Caucus group and giving more and more away to them. And at some point, you give away so much that they're basically dominating the agenda. And that's what we're seeing now. No, I think the public rendered a verdict on this last November. It's one of the reasons why the Republicans did so much less well than they were expected to do, because too many of them were election deniers. Too many of them were promising impeachment and investigations instead of progress on the problems that were touching people's lives. I think it's a political mistake for McCarthy and the Republicans to go down this road. And I think he may be, not only may he be a short-lived speaker given the concessions that he made that give them the right to throw him out, but the caucus itself may be a short-lived majority.
We've also seen him appoint, I mean, some of the most far-right members, Paul Gosar, Marjorie Taylor Greene, to the House Oversight Committee. I mean, Gosar, that's pretty amazing.
Paul Gosar is someone who's beyond election denialism, has trafficked in some very racist, some threatening sort of memes attacking Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Listen, this comes down to the fact that Kevin McCarthy needs votes. So he's going to try to keep that right flank happy at whatever cost he's able to. This big test is coming with the debt ceiling. And again, as many of us have said on the airways before, that right flank is never voting to raise the debt ceiling. There's no concessions that you could feasibly make them that are going to bring those votes over. Now is high time to be working with your moderates and seeing where you can get something done.
Yeah. Alyssa Farah Griffin, thank you so much. David Axelrod as well. Coming up, what did Alec Murdoch really say to investigators after the killings of his wife and son were in South Carolina with the defense argument about a crucial audio recording? Plus, Vladimir Putin's mercenary leader reaching out to CNN, his answer to a defector's claims of brutality and incompetence in the war in Ukraine. Saw the exclusive interview here last night. The response ahead. Well, could the murder case of Alec Murdoch come down to one simple word? Murdoch is on trial in South Carolina, accused of killing his wife Maggie and his then 22-year-old son Paul in 2021. Alec Murdoch was disbarred from practicing law. He comes from what was once considered a prominent legal family in the state. But his precise statement to law enforcement in the aftermath of the murders was today a big part of the legal battle in court. Randy Kaye was there in Walterboro.
According to your testimony, he says, "I did him so bad."
That is what I understood him to say, yes, sir.
Alec Murdoch's defense lawyer, cross-examining a special investigator and witness for the prosecution. The goal? To clear up what he heard, or thought he heard, Alec Murdoch say. That seemed to sound like a confession. When Alec was interviewed by investigators on June 10, 2021, just a few days after his wife and son were murdered, he said this when talking about his son, Paul.
It was just so bad. I did it so bad.
The witness, Special Agent Jeff Croft with SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, had told the court he thought Alec said, "I did him so bad." But the defense suggested Alec actually said, they did him so bad.
Did you consider that to be some sort of confession on June the 10th?
Again, it was something that we were definitely going to follow up on. Yes, sir.
Why didn't you ask him right then and there when he said, I did him so bad? Why didn't you ask him, what do you mean by that, Ellen?
Again, it was early in the investigation.
So what were the things going through your mind when you heard or misheard, I did him so bad? I mean, like, I wasn't a good dad? I spoiled him? Or I killed him? I mean, what was going through your mental note?
There was a mental note that it was definitely something that we needed to follow up on and ask at a later time.
The defense replayed the part of the interview in question at regular speed, then slowed it down to a third of the speed and played it again.
Your Honor, we'd like to play it again at one-third speed.
It's just so bad. It's so bad.
Did you hear they then?
No, sir, I did not.
Okay. But you would agree the jury gets to decide what he said on that tape. That's the best evidence.
Yes, sir.
The defense also got that same witness to tell the jury that the murder weapon that killed Paul Murdoch was not one of the guns collected from Alec's gunroom at the house. The witness said the ammunition wasn't a match either.
None of the shotguns that you brought yesterday, according to the ballistic report, your lab analysis, fired the shots that killed Paul, correct?
I do not have the lab report in front of me.
Have you ever found the murder weapons?
Not that I'm aware of, sir.
And you didn't find any similar ammunition at Moselle on June the 8th or any time after that, correct?
I did not, sir.
Still, John Bedingfield, Alec's second cousin and a captain with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, also testified for the state. He told the jury he built AR-style rifles for Alec Murdoch, the same type of rifle the prosecution says was used at the murder scene.
How many blackouts, AR-style rifles, did you make for Alec Murdoch?
Three.
And when was that last one made?
2018.
April?
April of 2018.
And Anderson, the defense was quick to point out in court how cooperative they say Alec Murdoch was with investigators from the start. They say that he granted them several interviews. He also helped them unlock his wife Maggie Murdoch's phone once it was found. He gave them the PIN code for that phone. And he did not ask them for a search warrant when they wanted to come into his home, seize those weapons and ammunition, and search his gun room. They wanted to make that point to the jury. Anderson?
Randy Kaye, thanks so much. I want to bring in veteran criminal defense attorney Mark O'Mara, also former prosecutor Vinny Politan. He's lead anchor for Court TV. Mark, obviously much of the focus today was on whether several days after the murders, Murdoch said to investigators, I did him so bad. As Randy reported, some construed that as a confession. The Murdoch defense says that he said they did him so bad. How important is this to the case?
You know, I don't think it's very important, and here's why. I don't think the prosecution should focus on that as being some significant piece of evidence, because quite honestly, if it was a confession, how dare the officer not look into it a little bit further? If he had somebody who said, I did him so badly, bring him along, go to the sympathy line of questioning that interrogators know how to do. But the idea that it came up as something that's now considered a confession, but not looked into, and quite honestly, not even looked into 3 months later when they talked to him again, I think the state has to be careful not to overplay it. I think it's minor, might fit into the rest of the evidence, but not too significant on its own.
Vinny, do you agree with that? Because, I mean, it is a law enforcement officer is the one who said he heard Murdoch say this.
Yeah, no, it's potentially huge. And, you know, the 12 jurors who are in the box, you know, they've never been through a murder trial before. They've never done a murder investigation, but they will rely upon some common sense. And I think Mark has something here on the common sense aspect. If a guy just confesses to murder and you don't ask a follow-up question, you don't, like, call him out on it. So I think prosecutors, again, they have to lean heavier on the timeline and the big lies that they can prove inside this courtroom.
Mark, when the defense argues that there could have been two shooters involved in the murders, is that a wise strategy? I mean, is it a wise strategy for the defense to essentially try to come up with as many different possibilities just to kind of have some sort of reasonable doubt in there?
Well, criminal defense 101, you don't have to prove innocence. You have to prove that there is reasonable doubt. So the idea of suggesting any alternative besides the one that the state is presenting is not a bad way to do it. And look, let's face it, the idea that there were two separate long guns, firearms used to commit this double murder, is a question that needs to be figured out. Now, again, if it was somebody planning a murder, as is the argument of the state, and it's true first degree premeditated murder, maybe you use two guns to throw off the scent. But it has to be explained some way, because generally speaking, you go in to kill two people, you bring one gun.
Vinny, I mean, the prosecution has also been leading, you know, heavily on motive. Are they overplaying their hand in this case, or is that one of their strongest arguments? Because, I mean, certainly this guy Murdoch has, there's a lot of skeletons in the closet here.
No, a lot of skeletons. Here's the thing about motive in this case. You know, I know, I think the viewers know that it's not a legal requirement for a prosecutor to prove motive. But if you as the state are coming inside a courtroom, especially here where I am in the low country of South Carolina, and you're saying this father is going to blow the brains out of his son with a shotgun and then hunt down his wife like a wild animal with an AR-style rifle, then you need to explain to them in some regard why he did it. Because otherwise, I think any level of doubt that they feel in this case will grow to reasonable doubt unless they can lean back and say, okay, well, I get it. I understand what the prosecution is saying about why he did it. Therefore, I'm more comfortable in finding this man guilty. So I think it's really important, but it's tough in this case because it's a non-traditional type motive.
Mark, how much will the jury know by the end of the, I mean, the allegations against Mr. Murdoch about his incredibly, I mean, criminal and sleazy and just morally bankrupt behavior of cheating clients and poor families for a long period of time has been? How much will they know about that?
It's going to be a very delicate balance. One, the state can't overplay their hand too much on that level of motive. As Vinny said, it is extraordinarily strange motive that we're trying to bring up. What we're trying to say is, look at everything he did wrong. Now that he's facing, you know, the fire on that, he's going to defer or try and deflect blame by killing his family. Very difficult. Plus, the judge is going to limit, because this type of prior bad acts, as we call it, only gets in to try and help prove some motive. But you have to be very careful, because you can't just say bad guy with all of this, so guilty guy here. So it's going to be tough. And again, I think the state has to be very careful and very precise how they present not only the motive, but the forensics and everything else in this case, because it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah. Mark O'Mara, Vinny Politan, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Up next, the leader of the Wagner mercenary group responds to my exclusive interview with an alleged Wagner defector about what he saw, or what he says he saw in Ukraine. A reply tonight from Yevgeny Prigozhin, leader of Russia's Wagner group, to my exclusive interview last night with a claimed defector from it. Andrei Medvedev is an orphan who spent 4 years in prison in Russia for robbery before joining Wagner. His service in Wagner was confirmed by Prigozhin previously. Here's part of what Andrei Medvedev told me about who he thinks is to blame for the brutality and murder he witnessed in his own ranks. And when you say the people who are guilty, who do you mean and what are they guilty of?
You know, I would like to take this opportunity of stating publicly, maybe other folk have different views about this, but the first culprit is Prigozhin, because he is the top leader.
Prigozhin runs the Wagner group. He's in charge of it.
Yes, him, absolutely.
We reached out to Yevgeny Prigozhin for comment. He sent us an email today, quoting from it, "Dear CNN, do you really think that we will discuss our military issues with you while you are our open enemy? It's the same as discussing military matters and sharing information with the CIA. It can be said with confidence that the Wagner Group is an exemplary military organization that complies with all the necessary laws and rules of modern wars." Mr. Prigozhin is welcome to come on the program anytime to discuss this further. We'd welcome it. In the grinding war between Ukraine and Russia, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seen by some as a potential mediator between the two countries, even as he faces an escalating conflict with Palestinians at home. He spoke about this exclusively with CNN's Jake Tapper. Here's a portion of it.
One thing I wanted to ask you about Russia and Ukraine is that an advisor to Zelensky floated your name as somebody who might be a decent mediator between Zelensky and Putin, between Ukraine and Russia. And I'm wondering if anyone in any position of power has ever floated that idea to you, and what would be your willingness to take on that job?
I was asked to do that early on in the breakout of the Ukraine war. And I was opposition leader at the time, and I said, well, I have a rule, one prime minister at the time, you know, like one president at the time.
Who asked you to do it?
I was asked. Okay. I don't know if it was official, but it was unofficial, so I didn't even pursue it. I said, there's a prime minister, let him, you know, decide what to do with that. He tried, didn't succeed. But if...
Would you do it now?
If I'm asked by both sides, and frankly, if I'm asked by the United States, because I think, you know, you can't have too many cooks in the kitchen, you know, and I'm, you know, we have our own backyard to deal with.
Right.
It's not that I think this is of monumental importance, because I think the peace of the world is at stake. As I think the peace of the world is at stake with Iran getting nuclear weapons, it'll destabilize the entire world. And so, you know, I'm really devoting my efforts to that and the other peace ideas that I have, and the economic ideas. But if asked by all relevant parties, I'll certainly consider it. But I'm not pushing myself in, if, you know, which is, you know, I've been around long enough to know that there has to be a ripe time and the ripe circumstances. If they arise, I'll certainly consider it.
Well, you can see more of that exclusive interview in just a few minutes. Jake Tapper, one-on-one with Benjamin Netanyahu, airs at 9 p.m. Eastern right here on CNN. We'll be right back. That does it for us. The news continues with Jake Tapper's exclusive interview with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, starting now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.